Good afternoon, everybody. My name is Mike Gibb. I run accountsrecovery.net, and I'm thrilled to be here today moderating our webinar on how the release of the proposed debt collection rule is impacting your business. Even though it is not yet final, and really honestly not anywhere near yet final, collection agencies are wondering whether some of the ideas proposed by the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, such as using email and text messages, are a good idea to implement now. We're fortunate to be joined by a panel of leading credit and collection industry executives to talk about how the proposed rule should and should not impact the operations at collection agencies and companies in the credit and collection industry. This webinar is being sponsored by Interpros. You'll get the chance to hear more about them a little later in our program. I want to take a quick minute and say a few words about accountsrecovery.net. Accountsrecovery.net is a news and information platform for the ARM industry. The site publishes unique and curated content, maintains a number of email newsletters, hosts webinars like this one, and offers a number of exciting podcasts for the ARM industry. The site is free for anyone in the industry to use and is a great resource of news and insights to help educate and inform. I hope you'll all spend a few minutes every day checking out what it has to offer. Now, let me tell you a little bit about today's speakers. Dennis Barton is the managing attorney of the Barton Law Group. He specializes in collection litigation throughout Missouri and Illinois, nationwide consumer law defense, compliance, and is on ACA International CNR letter review panel. Dennis graduated from the Indiana University School of Business and the Washington University School of Law. He is the Missouri Collectors Association past president and Missouri's ACA state compliance chair. Dennis is also a member of ACA International's MAP committee, education committee, and an ACA International certified instructor that presents nationwide on collection strategies, defense tactics, and compliance issues. Kelly Knepper-Stevens is the Vice President of Legal and Compliance and Associate General Counsel for True Accord. Her work focuses on government regulation, compliance, and civil litigation. Kelly serves on the Board of Directors for the Receivables Management Association International and is an ACA certified instructor. She also served as a small entity representative for the arbitration and debt collection rulemaking before the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. Her podcast, Two Dedicated Attorneys, along with fellow panelist Nicole Strickler, can be found on accountsrecovery.net. Collection Advisor Magazine named Kelly one of the 20 most powerful women in collections in 2018. Nicole Strickler focuses her practice in the defense of consumer litigation, including the FDCPA, Fair Credit Reporting Act, TCPA, and the Illinois Collection Agency Act. Her clients include corporations, lending institutions, collection agencies, asset purchasers, lawyers, as well as individuals. She is an active member of ACA International, the Consumer Financial Division of the American Bar Association, and holds a position on the board of directors of NARCA, the National Creditors Bar Association. The format for today's webinar will be a panel discussion. We encourage everybody to submit questions, and we will get to them as the discussion is ongoing and once it has concluded. To submit a question, please enter it into the question tab on your Zoom webinar control panel. This event is being recorded, and a recording will be made available in the coming days on accountsrecovery.net. Finally, before we start today's discussion, I wanted to ask everyone to take a minute and fill out the survey that should pop up on your screen after the webinar is over today. You'll also receive a link via email tomorrow to access the survey, so it's something you can do at your 4th of July cookouts. I'm sure everyone will be looking forward to that. Participating in the survey helps me develop content that's what you're looking for and make sure we find speakers like the ones we have today who are the people you want to hear from. With that, I've done most of my talking for today, and I'm going to bring on our panel now. What I'd like to do maybe is just start with an overview of the proposed rule, very high level. And maybe talk a little bit about where we are in the process and what's coming up, and then what are the next steps in that process. Kelly, would you mind walking us through that?
No, not at all. I'd be happy to. Hello, everybody. Thanks for joining us today. Happy to be presenting with Nicole and Dennis. Thanks, Mike, for including me. So the CFPB released their proposed rule, the NPRM. It seems like not very long ago, and it's 500 and some pages filled with information and their thoughts on edits to the FDCPA or their interpretation of the FDCPA. And when it goes into effect, which will be after a notice and comment period, we're in the notice and comment period now, but after it goes into effect, then their proposal will become the rule and something that everyone is required to follow. So right now, we as businesses that work in the space that are regulated by the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act have an opportunity to comment on the proposal, to provide thoughtful information to the CFPB about portions of the rule that will negatively impact consumers, your business, the economy, whatever. And you have until August 16th of this year to turn in your comments. And on the very first page of the Notice of Proposed Rulemaking, it has information about how you can go about submitting your comments to the rule. So I highly encourage anyone who is listening to think critically about a portion of the rule that you believe might have a negative impact on consumers or you, and to make your comments heard, because now is the only opportunity that you will get to provide those comments to the CFPB. Then after that comment period closes, the CFPB will go through reviewing all of those comments, will determine whether or not they're going to make any changes to the proposal. If they do make changes, then they will publish those changes when the rule becomes official. It will be published in the Federal Register, and there we will be given a certain period of time before which the rule takes effect. So if you've been following the payday lending rule, portion of the payday lending rule, which the final rule was published a while ago, it takes effect on August 19th of 2019. And after that time, you are required, it becomes, you know, official law, you must follow it. So that's what's happening with the Notice of Proposed Rulemaking. And it covers the entirety of the FDCPA with different exciting provisions that, you know, many in the industry have been waiting for, such as affirming our ability to communicate with consumers by email and text message, providing a call cap number, and providing safe harbor language when it comes to a model validation notice, which they have provided in the rule. Dennis, Nicole, what have I missed?
I think you hit the highlights pretty well. Nice job.
It sounds like you've made that explanation before.
What are you talking about? I'm very excited about this. I was very excited when the rule came out. We've all been waiting for some clarity, and I think that on the whole, the rule has some real positive things in it that help bring the CFPB up to the modern day, or the FDCPA, if you will, up to the modern day, at least, by, you know, confirming that ability to email and text message, and providing the method by which, you know, agencies would need to do so in order to comply with the law.
Excellent. Thank you very much. Like your fellow panelists said, Kelly, that was very informative and comprehensive. So thank you very much. What I'd like to do today is maybe go through some of the different concepts or provisions that were included in the proposed rule, and maybe spend a few minutes on each of them, talking about how agencies should not address these different provisions now while we're still in the proposal phase. So the first thing I'd like to talk about is the limited content message, which is a sort of canned message that collectors would be able to leave via voicemail or for individuals and not be subject to the FDCPA. You would not have to comply with the FDCPA if you use this limited content message. So, Dennis, let me ask you, how can or should agencies address the limited content message as been proposed by the CFPB? Is there anything that they can be doing now with respect to what's been proposed?
Well, the first thing they need to do now is to not change what they do now to match the limited content message, because the law hasn't changed to say that's okay. You know, it takes things out that we now need to be in. And I think it's a good reminder of, you know, as Kelly said, these are proposed rules and they don't go into effect. We're just talking about it. It's discussion time. This isn't lawmaking time. So don't react. It's the biggest advice I would have, and I'm sure my panelists feel the same. Don't match what you're doing now to what the CFPB says, because right now the limited content message takes us back 20 years, right? It says you don't say you're a debt collector. You don't say you're collecting a debt. You say who you are and, you know, what your number is and to call back and that kind of thing. So it's the kind of thing where you got to be careful not to react. That'd be my biggest advice to everybody. That was the question, right? I have a plan on what to do right now.
That was a question, and maybe we just wrapped up the entire webinar right there.
No, we didn't. We did. There's a lot more to cover. I was just talking about the limited content message. And I will say one thing, though, that when it does come out, the important thing to do on the limited content is, and the proposed rules make it pretty clear, too, it tells you what you can say. You know, and under the proposed rules, it's not a communication. But if you start saying other things other than what it tells, the very limited amount of things you're allowed to include in a limited content message, you're going to be in big trouble. My biggest advice is if this does become law, stay on the path. Don't go off the path. Stay on the path. Say what these people say you can say, and don't do anything else. Don't get creative. Don't get cute. Don't get tricky. Just say that.
So one of the things that I think is super exciting about the limited content message, apart from the fact that, you know, the Foti and Zortman case law has been, you know, unpleasant for those of us in the industry, especially because, you know, I think it's helpful to leave a message for a consumer to let them know that we're calling, as opposed to just keep calling and hanging up, right? Because ideally, if the consumer got the message, they would call back in. And so all the trouble with, you know, what you leave as the message is resolved in the rule by having this limited content message. And they provide, as Dennis was saying, what is required to be in the limited content message. And then they also provide some optional content, such as a salutation and a generic statement that the message relates to an account. And one of the things that they kind of contemplate in the rule and ask for comment on is whether or not the limited content message can be used in email. And I think that's something to think about, because email is another channel of communication that you have available to you as a debt collection company, right? Trying to reach consumers. And, you know, consumers sometimes put down their email on an account. But maybe there's a reason why you don't believe that's their email anymore, or you didn't get an email, you know, that information wasn't filled out and you're trying to reach the consumer. So similar to how you skip trace an address or you skip trace a phone number, you know, can you skip trace consumers' emails and then use the limited content message to, you know, see if you've reached the consumer that you are attempting to contact. The CFPB is interested in whether or not that's something you would want to do and has requested comment on that.
Hey, Kelly, this is Dennis. One thing I'll add to what you just said, you brought up the word account, and you're right. The CFPB does say you can add a couple things to this very basic message, like hi, and we're referring to your account. But if you go and you give an account number, there's a good argument that you're off the path.
Yeah.
And you now have gone from a message which is not subject to the FDCPA because it's not considered a communication to regular old out there in the woods and subject to the lawsuits. So be very, very careful if you want to start adding things, because saying the word account is okay, but giving the account number is not okay. And so those distinctions are important.
Yeah, for sure.
Okay, excellent. Appreciate getting that part taken care of and getting that in that section, those provisions talked about. What I'd like to do at this point is pause the discussion, and I'd like to invite Aaron Ryder from InterPros, the sponsor of today's webinar, to say a few words. Aaron?
Hey, Mike. Thanks. And thanks to the panelists, Kelly, Nicole, and Dennis. It's nice to have you all here for this. There's a lot of conversation taking place on this topic. So when Mike put out the call for a sponsor for this discussion, we were all over it. Proposed rules have numerous potential impacts to the industry, and our role as a software platform provider with InterPros ACE for debt recovery agencies or departments and first party means that we're actively involved in ensuring our customers are complying with rules and regulations. So these changes are of particular interest to us. As Kelly mentioned, we are pretty excited about the proposed clear guidance rules for methodology changes, or at least clarifications. But we found that we're ahead of most of the rules that affect software platforms. So whether it's ensuring that records are saved and organized for years, or removing and adding processes, or making sure audits are the required level, a modern solution like ACE, which is our flagship product, makes these pivots easy. And we're already in compliance with most of the new proposed provisions. InterPros is devoted to supporting the debt recovery market. It's all we do. And as I've stated before, we're pretty great at it, and we have a lot of fun doing it. So if this is a concern of yours and you're listening in that you've got a platform that might not be able to pivot with these changes, and you're looking for a like-minded partner to modernize, we're here for you. InterPros.com, InterPros.com. Thanks, Mike. Again, thanks to all the panelists.
Thank you, Aaron. And thanks again to InterPros for sponsoring today's webinar. Really appreciate your support and your commitment to helping the industry better understand the changes that are going to be impacting the industry for a long time to come. Going back to the limited content message, the question came in, and I'll use this opportunity to ask it so we can take care of it, but also to remind everybody, if you have a question for our panel, type it in, and we'll do our best to get to it during the hour we have today. The question is, how about just providing the last four numbers of an account number or some other key info, such as creditor name or the value that is outstanding, to help the consumer recognize that the contact is legitimate versus a typical phishing email that has no information? Does anyone want to tackle that one?
Well, I think the danger and the reason why the CFPB doesn't want more information is it's still an attempt to try to balance the privacy of the consumer versus, you know, our ability to communicate, right? So providing too much information is a concern of the CFPB in trying to protect the consumer's privacy you know, in the event that, you know, a third party might overhear that communication. And so they're worried about that. So I don't know really if it's going to make that large of a difference in adding that creditor information into the limited content message. I suppose it could be arguable that, you know, it would look a little bit more legitimate as opposed to phishing, but I think the ultimate concern of the CFPB is adding in that extra information would be more risky to the consumer in the event it's overheard by a third party. That's my thought.
Yeah, I would agree. I would reiterate that if you want to be giving the limited content message, you need to stick to the way in which the CFPB is telling you to do it in the rule, as Dennis, you know, had mentioned, because by giving that additional account information, you might be taking it outside of the limited content message, and then you're no longer getting the protection that is provided in the rule. But I think the person who asked this question is making a very good point, and it's something that you need to think about when you're approaching emailing consumers, which is, how do you, and it's the same thing on the phone call, right? You still have that same sort of hurdle to get the consumer to recognize that you are a legitimate business and this is not a phishing email. This is not spam. And so you need to be thinking about that with your entire email strategy. And that includes everything from what is going to be in your subject line of your emails that you're going to be sending consumers. You know, you don't want it to appear to be a spam email. In the rule, the CFPB talks about what the subject line needs to be for specific emails. So if you're emailing dispute documentation, if you're emailing the initial demand notice within 5 days of your initial communication, then you are required to have some piece of account information, like the name of the creditor and maybe the last 4 digits of that account in the subject line. And there's concern about, well, if you're doing that, is that going to look more like spam or not? You know, and so those are really important things that that you need to think about. And when Nicole's talking about the word overheard, you could just insert the word overread, right? If someone else is going to be able to see that email, or you're disclosing it to a person that is not the consumer you're attempting to reach, then you have that same concern of third-party violation that you would if someone were to overhear the message that was left on the answering machine, right? But if you send the SMS to the wrong party, if you send the SMS or the email to not the consumer's email, or to an email that is, you know, thefamilystevens@gmail.com, is there someone else who's seeing that shouldn't be seeing, right? That's not the consumer. Because you can get the same third-party violation claim. Now, TrueAccord, the company where I work for, we've been emailing consumers since we got into business. That is our business model. And we've had very limited third-party violation claims. You know, we had one somewhat ridiculous one where someone said, yeah, I share my email with my roommate. Okay, well, her email was kstevens, you know, @gmail.com. Not likely that you are to share an email that has your first initial and your last name with your roommate whose name's like Peter, you know, Frampton or whatever. So,
well,
go ahead.
I can tell you though, and my next door neighbors who are married and they're my age, they're in their 30s, they have one email address. And it's like Gutierrez1977@gmail.com. No one copied that because that's actually their email address. So I'll know it was somebody on this call. But, you know, so that would be, you know, which I, at the time, I guess I thought to myself, like, that's kind of weird. Like, you know, everyone kind of has their own email. But, you know, I think particularly maybe like older families or families that, you know, maybe, you know, they both have their work emails, but their you know, their email for their, like, you know, personal purposes, they share. I mean, I've seen people that share Facebook accounts, right?
Yeah.
So it's both, you know, the husband and the wife, like, have the same Facebook account, and they utilize it. So I don't think it's that odd that it would come up.
Yeah, and that's a good point, and points to another area of the rule where the CFPB actually provides the best practices that you can implement to defend yourself from a third-party violation claim if you are communicating with consumers via email. And their bona fide error defense that they put in the section of the rule, which I have, like, totally over highlighted here, and I'll give you all later that it's on. Is this the one? Yeah, it's on page 456 and 455. So the reasonable procedures for email and text message communications. The CFPB in their proposed rule says that you are maintaining proper procedures to avoid a third party claim. If when communicating with a consumer by email or by text message, you are getting the email address or the telephone number either from the consumer themselves because they reached out to you from that email or from that phone number. That's one way. and when the consumer reaches out to you, it's okay if they're reaching out to you from their work email address. That is the only time it is okay to use a work email address under the rule. You need to get that directly from the consumer. It specifically says an email address or text message that the consumer recently used to contact the debt collector. And then the other two ways that you can have reasonable procedures to avoid a third party claim or a third party violation is by using getting a non-work email address or a non-work telephone number. I refer to this as like, the handoff letter notice. If you are communicating with the consumer within 30 days of the creditor or the debt collector sending the consumer a letter saying, hey, we're going to use this email or this phone number to text or email you, or we've hired this debt collection company, they're going to text or email you at these numbers, and this is how you would opt out of those sort of communications. So I call that a warm transfer letter. It's not called a warm transfer letter in the rule itself, but that's sort of the idea that it's getting at there. And then the third way to protect yourself from a bona fide error defense is if you are getting a non-work email address or a non-work telephone number that the creditor or a prior debt collector got from the consumer recently and was recently sending communications about the debt to that non-work email address or non-work telephone number. So those are the ways, the three ways in which you can get a email or a text phone number from the consumer or use that number in a way to protect yourself from a third-party violation claim. The Gutierrez family or whatever your next door neighbors, 1977@gmail.com, if they, had reached out to you from that email, it would be okay to use it. If you had sent them a letter and said, hey, we're going to reach out to you at Gutierrez 1977, this would be how you would opt out. If they had recently been communicating from that email with the creditor or prior debt collector, then in those instances, you'd have a bona fide error defense.
I think it was important, Kelly, that you also like carved out or made a note to carve out the whole work email address. I mean, if you look through the proposed rules, the CFPB seems very protective of work email addresses and don't look kindly upon that. So that's another consideration. I think that you could almost, most of the case law on the communications at work have involved physical letters being sent to work that were thereafter opened by, some other department that opens mail. But at the same time, it seems to me like the CFPB is basically saying, no work email. Any other thoughts on that?
Well, I do have kind of a question for you and Dennis, and that involves, all right, so the CFPB has outlined what they believe to be the best practices to find an email and use it when communicating with consumers. Is this something that you should implement now in your policies and procedures? Or is it something that you should wait until the rule is finalized?
I don't know. Maybe Dennis, you'll disagree with me, but I think this is something that you can start to implement now in terms of the location of the email addresses. I mean, there's nothing that's in the FDCPA that says you can't email. Like, people were very hesitant to begin email campaigns. I think there was a lot of confusion about what the regulations would be and, how it would interact with the FDCPA. But, I mean, it's still doable at this point in time. And I think taking some of those some of the guidance from the CFPB on emailing is good. Kelly, I know your business is like, a lot of emails, right? But the considering all the emails your company has sent and the one third party disclosure claim it's gotten over the years, I think it's a fairly low risk scenario as long as you're doing it right. You know, I don't know what your thoughts are, Dennis.
I mean, I agree with a lot of that. What I don't want to tell my clients is to limit what they're allowed to do now, but might not be allowed to do later. And getting information and skipping if they're skipping for email addresses and they found that to be a profitable practice, I don't want to tell them, hey, you know what, later can be, prohibited, so stop doing it now. So, I feel comfortable telling my clients that there might be a risk in doing it, but there's no prohibition against it now, and there will be later, so at least plan to change your practices. But I'm always very hesitant to tell someone to stop doing something that's making them money if it's not prohibited under the law.
And we don't know if it's going to be prohibited. And I think something else people need to realize is that right now, pretty much what the CFPB says is semi-irrelevant. I mean, the district courts are still the ones that are going to be, interpreting and rendering these decisions for, realistically another 18 months minimum for the rules to actually come into effect. So, following what's currently been deemed to be okay by federal courts is still at play.
Well, that's a good point. I mean, all the CFPB does, it fills in some gaps that the legislature, that it feels the legislature had. And then a court's going to say, well, yeah, but I don't think you're doing that properly. And so you, executive branch, don't get to change that law, don't get to change the law in that way. So Nicole makes a good point that, we hoped that this was going to avoid litigation by removing some, by clarifying some things, but yeah, it may or may not.
We have a couple other questions on this topic, one of which is, are we recommending that the initial email be sent out requesting that the person validate or verify the email beforehand? I think your danger there is that's going to be considered your initial communication, right? So mm-hmm. It's going to trigger your validation period. And there's some uncertainty in the law about what type of consent you need to have to be able to give those statutory rights via electronic conveyance. So I don't know that it's really going to make a big difference if you're sending an email requesting the person validate or verify the email before. And I don't know what that would look like really, but it's probably going to be a communication and it's probably going to trigger your validation. That's kind of my thoughts.
From a practical standpoint, I agree with you that, I mean, I agree with your assessment that it's an initial communication. From a practical standpoint, it just doesn't make any sense. The closest you could do, or the better maybe practice would be if you send the email, you could have a line in there that talks about, if there's a better email to use, or if you prefer not to use email, then inform us. But otherwise, I think once you send the email, that shit's kind of sailed. To just didn't have to verify that this seems not like a productive use of time.
Yeah, and the rule sort of gets at two things that are important here. The first one is a best practice in the rule is to have an unsubscribe on every email. They call it the opt-out notice for electronic communications. They want to see an opt-out notice on every type of electronic communication, whether you're using text message or email. And that's just a general best practice to have anyways. And then, of course, you need to think through what that opt-out does in your system, right? Do you have a field in your collection software system now that keeps track of, whether or not you have a consumer that's opting out of that electronic communication, and how you set up your opt-out in terms of, when the consumer clicks on opt-out, are you going to opt them out of all communication? Are you going to have some sort of opt-out flow so that if they're clicking on opt-out, some other box appears and it says, are you opting out of all communication? Are you just opting out of email? Or you're not going to give the consumer that choice, and when they opt out, they're solely opting out of email communication? that's something you're going to want to think through and make sure that you're gathering that information and passing it on to the creditor for whom you're collecting. The other thing that I was thinking about when you were talking about this is that the CFPB also talks about two ways to email that kind of gets at some of the case law that Nicole and Dennis were referring to. And by some of the case law, there's like one case. It's in the Seventh Circuit. It's at the Seventh Circuit. We're waiting for the Seventh Circuit ruling to come out. There was thought that the Seventh Circuit was like holding on to their ruling until the proposed rule came out. Okay, guys, the rule's out. You know, could you go ahead and post your decision? It's the Med 1 versus Lavalle case, L-A-V-A-L-L-E. If you put that in, I'm sure you'll find some stories on accountsrecovery.net relating to that lawsuit. Essentially, the initial demand notice was sent by the debt collector to the consumer via email, and it was sent with a link. So the email body did not contain the validation notice or other information. It contained a link for the consumer to click on that brought the consumer to a page where the consumer had to enter some validation information, like identity information, in order to see, to have the validation notice revealed to them. And the CFPB talks about that in their rule. They say, when you're emailing consumers, you can either put the whole text of your communication in the body of the email, or you can do it by having a hyperlink and, you know, having the hyperlink set up that way. What the court said in the Lavalle case, which is kind of important and something you should be thinking about, is, you know, if you have a hyperlink and the consumer is kind of goes back to spam, has no idea who you are as a debt collector, what idiot consumer is going to click on that link, right? If they didn't know who you were, that would be very dangerous for them because they could be clicking on a hyperlink that's going to, you know, give them a virus or some other computer problem, right? There's no way for them to know that it's not spam. And that's what the court decision talked about in that Med One case was, you know, the Department of Defense recommends against clicking on hyperlinks from strangers that you receive in your email. So we cannot, the court said, the court would not presume that the consumer had received the validation notice in this instance, right? So I think this case is very specific to hyperlink notices. Because if you're sending the notice in the body of the email, when the consumer opens the email, there's the validation notice. It's a bit different, but once that email's been opened, the consumer has received that notice as opposed to in the other case. So those are things to be thinking about when you're considering whether or not you're going to send your initial validation notice by email.
We've got a couple other questions on email. One of which is a question about attempting to get the account holder to call the collector by using email. And the question is, can you say something as simple as, you know, hey, John Smith, please call me concerning a matter I'm needing to contact you about. I can be reached at 800-888-8888. Another attendee asked this question. I mean, this would be no different than leaving a voicemail message that said that. And would you be able to send that or to send that particular message? You know, the prevailing view is still FODI, and so the answer is going to be no, because you're not disclosing your status as a debt collector. But you know, we do have some competing case law. But I think you. The answer basically is no to that question, at least in my view. I don't know if anybody on the panel differs.
If this is someone for whom I represent on the defense side, I'd like them to continue to do that practice. That's a great way to get a lawsuit. You mentioned FODI, where you kind of give the full mini Miranda, and there's the other option that a lot of courts have approved, which is the Zortman message, which is FODI light, where you have to say you're a debt collector, but you don't get into the full mini Miranda. But either way, I've never seen it, at least, I mean, maybe you have, but I've not seen a case where the person just said, you know, call me back and mention the fact that the caller was a debt collector and that not be a violation. Now, under limited content, it won't be, but it is now. So another reason not to adopt things, everything in the proposed rules now, because doing so will put you in great jeopardy.
I totally agree with that opinion, Dennis. You know, but eventually people are going to have to start thinking about, you know, as the when the rules do come down, how to implement them. We have another question about recommendations on getting this information out to your collectors. Like, what's the best way to do that? Kelly, I don't know what you're being from the in-house world. What do you think about that? About relaying these types of or eventually relaying these types of regulations to the collector, like what works best?
Yeah, so you have to think about that right now, which is good that you're here, right? Because you already are thinking about it. And you need to think about, number one, what information from this, you know, notice of proposed rulemaking do you think is relevant to what you're doing right now that you might want to implement right now, even though it's not a final rule? And then what information are we going to wait and we're not going to implement until it's a final rule? And know that the CFPB is going to give you some kind of time to ramp up before the rule takes effect after they publish the final rule. 90 days, 120 days, something like that. So you'll have some time to prepare. So after the final rule's published, you know, let's take the call restrictions, right? So the CFPB in their proposed rulemaking is their proposed rule is that you get 7 call attempts per account. Once you get the consumer on the phone in 1 week period, you get 7 call attempts. Once you get the consumer on the phone, you get no more call attempts that week. Okay. So that's their proposal. That's not law now. If your rule at your collection agency is that you have 14 call attempts per account per week, you might want to think about, well, should I change my practice now, knowing that the CFPB thinks 7 is the max? That's a consideration you could do right now. But you don't need to make any official changes until the rule becomes a final rule and you know that, you know, starting on whatever date in the future, sometime in 2020 or 2021, after that point, it's going to be 7 calls per week. Does that make sense? Other panelists?
Totally.
Okay. Sure.
Yeah, sure.
Go ahead, Nicole.
Oh, no, go ahead, Dennis.
Well, you know, and I was going to make kind of a broader point, and forgive me if I'm stretching the question too far, but it seems to kind of link to the larger question of what can we do now? Do we start training people? What can we do now? And, you know, I think the number of calls example is a good example of, Kelly made a good example of something you could change now if you wanted to and still be compliant and all that. To me, it seems like once these rules get implemented, there's going to be a 3-step process for an agency from a practical standpoint. First is the agency, I'll call it management. You're going to have to learn, oh my God, what are the rules? And what do we have to do? What are the changes in the law? The second step, it, kind of going to the question is, how do we train our employees? And, you know, we have to train them, and what's the most effective way? But the third step, and I think the third step is the most important, well, I don't know if it's the most important, but very important, and probably the most difficult and the one that gets overlooked the most, is the technology side and how to make sure that, okay, we got our people trained, but oh my God, I just realized our system can't handle this, or I have to make a whole bunch of changes. You know, there's still a lot of agencies that use, you know, kind of an older system or a legacy platform system with their collection management software, and you know, they have old programming versus the newer programming with the more modern platform, I guess, like Interpros, I'll say. I know Aaron and I have talked a lot about everything that Interpros can do, and you know, one of the best things about a company like Interpros and the software that it has is how versatile it is and how much it, you know, and how quickly it can adapt to the changing law. Well, that's great, because when you can only call somebody once in a 7-day time period, let's say, oversimplifying the law a little bit, but you know, let's say that, you know, that's where we're at, absent exceptions. Well, your system better be able to tell people not to call that, or maybe even block the number for outgoing calls, but not incoming calls. And you're going to have a system that's able to do it. Now, some of the older systems aren't going to be able to do it. Some of the older systems, and the point is, whether it can or can't, you're going to have to find out, and you better do it now, because if you have to change a system, we all know it takes, you know, a good 12 to 18 months to have things fully implemented and fully changed. So say somebody wanted to switch to InterPros because they have an old system and they want a newer system that's capable of adapting. Well, now's the time, or soon is the time. So when you're talking about what we can do now and what we need to do now, that is a need to do now sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. And then you want to think about, okay, you know, if you're going to make a change now, update your policies and procedures, train your employees, implement monitoring and controls to make sure that they're following any new policies and procedures that you've done, and then any remediation that happens when you find a deficiency, right? And same thing when the rule comes out, right? When the rule comes out, you're going to update your policies and procedures. You're going to train your employees on those new policies and procedures. You're going to implement monitoring and controls, right? You're going to update your QA form so that when you're listening to calls or when your call miner's listening to calls or whomever, you know, they're listening to make sure that the limited content message is exactly as you've said it should be. And then if it's not, you're going to remediate.
So we have another question here about whether it makes a difference if the notices or communications are made directly by the creditor as opposed to a third-party collector. So for this person out there, the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act, for most purposes, does not apply to the creditor. It applies to debt collectors. So these rules really don't affect creditors unless the creditor is doing something like using a false name or something that would bring them under the auspices of the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act. So that's a quick answer to that question. And then we have one other one from Larry. And he would like to know from the contact restrictions, if the consumer requests that they receive a return call, you're not prohibited from making that return call. I believe that is correct. Do my other panelists disagree?
No, that's correct. The one danger you have is, so if they call and you call, you know, you've called and then they call within that 7-day time period and ask you to call back. Well, that's kind of your exception. You can call back, but if you do it, you can only do it once, and then your 7-day starts all over until another exception arises. So again, that's going to be something where you're going to have software that keeps track of that, or at least have, you know, a method by which your accounts document that really well, so you don't fall into the trap of calling someone too early. Oh, hey, Nicole, I wanted to actually make a quick comment on something you said about the creditor. I agree that a lot of these aren't going to apply to the creditor. One way it kind of does, though, is that, you know, they're going to be having third-party collectors collect on their behalf, and they're going to want to make sure that, you know, their collectors are doing, you know, following the law. So the way in which creditors, the way I see it anyway, that they still need to be aware of all this stuff is more of a oversight than anything.
And I think also you do have those states out there that we can't forget about where they have the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act, and they do apply to creditors specifically. So there may be some interplay, so to speak, depending upon, you know, the particular facts, but we can't obviously ignore that there are state regulations as well that cover creditors. To answer this follow-up question about if a creditor is redirecting to a collection agency, well, then obviously the collection agency is acting as a debt collector, so the FDCPA does apply.
Good point on the state. You know, we get so focused on the federal sometimes because of how much there is to keep track of that we got to make sure that, you know, we stay on top of the state regulations as well. I mean, one of the bigger things with the validation notices for the CFPB is talking about itemization. Well, if you're in the state of Washington, you've already got the big itemization hit because of all the state regs that take effect in July. and every, all the changes you need to make there about itemizing things in your validation notes. So excellent point, Nicole, about keeping track of state as well as federal law.
And, you know, this is
so complicated.
It's just a good practice point for emailing and text messaging. Your state language obligations apply when you're sending emails or text messages. So you want to make sure that, you know, anything that you're doing in writing, if you have some sort of notice on your collection letter because it's required in the state of North Carolina, that same notice needs to be in emails that you're sending to consumers that live in the state of North Carolina. And I did want to kind of mention, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, we talked about email a lot, and I always like to mention this to people on these types of webinars. Like, you can't forget about the states, right? So there are states out there that have specific email-related legislation, like New York. And so you're still going to have to comply with those state regulations. Like New York, for instance, the biggest thing is, you know, they require debt collectors get consent directly from the consumer in order to email first. So that's a more restrictive rule than, you know, the proposed debt collection rules. And because it's more restrictive, you're going to have to comply with that law, at least in the state of New York. That's right. Something a lot of people don't know. So
yeah, you are prohibited from emailing a New York consumer about their debt at all until you have their consent. And if they attempt to consent for you to communicate via email with them at a work email address, that consent is invalid. In the state of New York, you're not permitted to email a consumer at their work email. Even if the consumer is saying, I want you to email me at work, you may not. So that's a really important distinction as well. There's also very...
You know, that's interesting, Kelly. So even if the consumer like specifically says, I want you to send me an email to my work, like, you don't think that would, it'd be waivable? Like, they couldn't waive that?
I mean, regulation? The way the law is written, no. I think it's very frustrating for a consumer who often only has a work email address. That can happen. And I think I think the New York email law is really unfortunate. I think that it forces agencies to communicate in writing when a consumer is like opposed to it. and would want and welcome, you know, email communication. So when the creditor's only been communicating with the consumer via email, and then all of a sudden, you know, the consumer starts getting letters in the mail, you know, and they're like, what the heck? You know, it's too bad for the consumer. It's out on an opportunity to make that transition from working with the creditor directly to their, you know, account going into default and having to communicate with the debt collection company. It's unfortunate for them. And it probably results in a lot of folks ending up in a litigation route that wouldn't otherwise be in a litigation route. It's unfortunate.
That topic actually reminds me of the very first question where, you know, it's a good-hearted, well-intended, you know, collector saying, hey, you know, can I put the last four numbers of the account, you know, digits of the account number so somebody knows what I'm talking about? I don't think it's a spam email. And here, okay, you know, if somebody says they can email me in New York, can I still do it? And it goes to show that just because something will help the consumer doesn't necessarily make it illegal. Just because it's, you know, intuitively correct doesn't make it okay. So that's an easy trap to fall into, thinking, well, okay, well, if the consumer asks for it, it's good for the consumer, so why wouldn't I do it? Well, sometimes it's not okay to help the consumer.
Yeah. And that's the one obstacle I see with this rule. I think there's a little bit of dispute when it's to, if you are sending your initial communication, the validation notice and consent from the consumer or not. I think on page 481 of the rule, it makes clear that when you're sending your initial communication by email and you are attempting to satisfy 1692G by putting the full validation notice in that initial communication by email, that you still have to have e-signed consent from the consumer. Someone was talking about, you know, working with the creditor or whatever. This is something that's really important to go back and talk about now, particularly if you're emailing with consumers, because a lot of creditors are not actually getting e-sign consent, right? E-sign not only requires that you provide a full set of disclosures, it also requires that the consumer manifest that they can communicate in the way in which you are going to give them the notice, right? So in email or in text message. So in order to manifest that they're doing that, they need to perhaps reply to an email or email you directly. So you need to think through those sort of steps or processes. And this is something where I think it's unfortunate as well, and I'm gonna comment on this directly to the CFPB. The consumer provides their email to the creditor and says, I wanna communicate via email. In some cases, the account is originated only with that, you know, email address, right? The consumer signs up for the loan online, uses their email address, communicates with the, you know, creditor via email. In that point, the creditor should be able to place the account that defaults or gets charged off with the collection agency and allow, and that consent that was given you know, in that originating contract should allow you to then communicate with the consumer in that same way by email, regardless of whether or not e-sign consent was obtained. And so that's a big area, I think, because, you know, e-sign to me is a little outdated. I think most consumers today know that they know how to email, right? We don't need them to prove to us that they can email.
Right. Well, that's what happens when you have laws and they're on the books and years go by and technology changes, then, you know, they don't necessarily keep up, you know. We can certainly say that about the TCPA, I think, so. But nonetheless, it's the make do.
Someone did ask about the suggested subject line verbiage in sending a message. For texting and emailing, there is a proposed subject line when you're sending the initial demand, a dispute, a response to a dispute via email. I'm trying to find the page number that's on. It requires, off the top of my head, two pieces of information about the account, right? So, you know, about your, you know, France bank account number ending in 123 is kind of.
I think isn't it the, and I could be wrong, but I think it's the creditor to whom the debt is owed has to be in there, and then another piece of information,
yes,
about the account, right?
Right?
Wasn't
that's
it specific?
Right.
Yeah.
I'm looking for that. I know it's in here somewhere. Anyways,
I'm pretty sure they gave an example, like if you could have like account number or something like that, but it's some other type of identifying information is how they describe it.
Yep.
Well, I'm sorry that I have to step in and bring this discussion to a close, because it's been really, really interesting and a great opportunity for me personally. I can't speak to everybody else, but I hope everyone else has learned as much as I have during this, you know, during the conversation listening to Dennis and Nicole and Kelly share their insights and their perspectives on a dynamic that is going to, you know, sort of change the collection industry for the next generation. And to sort of get that insight, I think, is incredibly valuable. So on behalf of everybody, panel, thank you very much for sharing your time and your insights with us today. This was a great discussion, and it went far better than anything I could have hoped for heading into this. So thank you very much.
I found
thank
it.
Thanks
much.
For having us.
It's page
478. Thanks for the sponsor, Interpros.
Yes.
Thanks. Yeah. I want to thank Interpros again for sponsoring. Aaron, great job. Anyone who's interested in learning more about the company can go to www.interprose.com. Thanks to everybody who asked questions and participated. A recording of this event will be posted to accountsrecovery.net later today. And make sure to fill out the feedback survey, which you should get hopefully either today or tomorrow when you get back in the office. Please stay tuned to accountsrecovery.net for news and more webinars in the very near future, including 4 that we have on the calendar for next week. Look forward to seeing you then. I hope everyone has a great holiday this week. Thank you very much. Take care, everyone. Enjoy the rest of your day.
Thanks, everyone.
Thank you.
That was great.
Thanks, Aaron. Bye, everybody.